Welcome to Merely Catholic with me, Gavin Ashenden. On World Youth Day in Rio de Janeiro 2013, Pope Francis, excited by the crowds of young people, adopted something of the energetic creativity of the teenagers he was surrounded by and exhorted them to make a mess. He said, "I want to tell you something. What is it that I expect as a consequence of World Youth Day? I want a mess. We knew that in Rio there would be great disorder, but I want trouble in the dioceses. I want to see the church get closer to the people. I want to get rid of clericalism, the mundane, this closing ourselves off within ourselves, in our parishes, schools or structures, because these need to get out." Well, whether or not trouble has entered the dioceses, mess, ambiguity and trouble has certainly been characteristics of the new format synod that's taking place in Rome at the time of this broadcast. Five troubled cardinals exercised their right to put questions to Pope Francis, asking for clarifications. And instead of answering in the prescribed yes or no form, a theologically sophisticated range of answers were provided within 24 hours, suggesting either a degree of anticipated preparation or else a seriously well-stocked team of theologians working through the night, writing in the Pope's name and with his mandate. But the answers raised yet more questions, as might well be expected. Dr. Jules Gomez is presently the Rome correspondent for St. Michael's Media, but he also holds a PhD from Cambridge University in Biblical Studies and has authored five highly regarded books, which gives him more sophisticated theological credentials than most. So I turned to Jules to ask him for help in unravelling the complexities of the dubia and the subsequent theological conversations that has flowed from it. And he joins me now. Jules, thank you so much for making yourself available in Rome to talk to us on this podcast. It's very good to have you here because we're in need of experts. So what has happened is that with some excitement, five cardinals have issued a dubia, and instead of answering yes or no, the Pope has answered them, and through his answering, the whole issue of homosexual blessing has been thrown up. Jules, can you please give us a bit of background and context and bring us chronologically up to date?
Gavin, the background that is needs to be considered above all is the Synod on Synodality. And a number of contentious issues have been raised. And one of those issues is the issues of same-sex blessings. The other issues, of course, as we know, include issues of the ordination of women, the inclusion of divorced and remarried couples into receiving the sacraments, etc., etc. Worried by all these developments, five cardinals, Raymond Burke, Walter Brand Mueller, Joseph Zen, Juan Sandoval Iniguez, and of course, Cardinal Robert Sarra, wrote to Pope Francis on the 10th of July, asking for clarifications on five questions, in Latin, five dubia or doubts. And these were issues of doctrinal development, the blessing of same-sex unions, the authority of the Synod on Synodality, women's ordination, and sacramental absolution. And the Pope responded in a day. However, because he did not respond in the conventional yes or no answers, the cardinals reformulated their questions and they wrote back to him. Now, a couple of days ago, you know, the bomb shells dropped on the playground of the Catholic world, in the playground of the Catholic world, and these cardinals, not getting a response, released their questions to the faithful. Immediately, in response, Cardinal Victor Manuel Fernandez, who is the prefect of the Dicastery of the Doctrine of the Faith, released Pope Francis's five answers, his five responses to the cardinal's dubia. And that is where we stand. There is now intense discussion over Pope Francis's responses and what he meant and what he did not mean.
So just for the sake of clarity, and thank you very much, that was very good. The Pope is under no obligation to answer dubia, either with a torrent of theologically honed words or with the more welcome yes or no, because he's had one before and he simply ignored it. Do you think he's going to ignore the request to reformulate his answers into yes or no? What will happen at this point, do you think, pragmatically?
He did not respond to the dubia in 2016. submitted to him by four cardinals, including Walter Brandmuller and Raymond Burke, by the way, on issues relating to Amoris Laetitia. What the Pope will now do, and what I think Fernandez has made quite clear, is that he's not going to continue this discussion with these five cardinals. He has responded at length. If they want what liberals are calling a pharisaical kind of yes or no responses, the Pope, as supreme legislator, is not going to give them, is not going to respond to them on their terms. He has responded full stop.
One of the interesting aspects of this to me is the theological argument or the trajectory that lies behind it. If I can interject for a moment, so that, to ask you to help clarify my thinking, I've been taken by the way in which the Pope has talked about the idea of development in doctrine, because this seems to me to be the platform upon which this enterprise is based. And of course, you and I as ex-Anglicans are particularly invested in that with all the work that Newman did. Although I must say, having been reading Newman on it, it's not as straightforward as one might expect, particularly the distinction between development and contradiction. The three areas in which he thought this applied to particularly were slavery, the death penalty, and sexuality. I'm hesitant to criticize the Pope's theological acumen, but it did seem to me that, in fact, the Church's teaching on slavery has never changed. Human beings are made in the image of God, image and likeness of God. One of the great things about Catholic theology has always been the sacredness of the human person, and what other regimes do with slaves practically and politically is not always open to the Catholic Church to affect. But the principle of slavery has always been the same, because it has to do with incarnation and the status of human beings in relationship to the Father. Then the death penalty is really quite interesting, because there's been a very interesting article written in First Things about the way in which John Paul II changed some of the language in the revised 97 edition of the Catechism. Because when Pope Francis did the same thing in 2018 and effectively changed the way in which the Catholic Church's teaching understands the way the death penalty is regarded. Now, critics have said that he had no right to change the Catechism, because the Catechism is, in fact, a reflection of the Church's teaching. And without having formally changed the Church's teaching, changing the Catechism is the wrong way around. But he did do it, and nobody objected. And essentially, the difference was that he said the Church was committed to working for its total prohibition throughout the world. So now we move on to sexuality, without either of those two having convincingly been changed in the Church's teaching. And the question I think a lot of lay Catholics are going to be asking themselves is, does the Pope have the right, through, I won't say casual correspondence, because it's enormously weighty correspondence, but does he have the right through weighty correspondence to change the teaching of the Church, clearly not in developmental terms, but in terms of contradiction, but simply by the stroke of a pen in correspondence? What's the answer, Jules?
The answer is twofold. First of all, the Pope is the supreme legislator in the Catholic Church. He can make laws. He doesn't have to consult anybody. He can make laws. He can reverse laws. He can reinterpret laws, which is what he says he's doing. But secondly, we must remember that the Pope is also the supreme interpreter. And at the end of the day, whether what has gone before him in scripture and tradition is being contradicted or is being developed is a matter of interpretation. And finally, it is in the Pope's domain to interpret or to interpret and say, well, Gavin, you may think that it is a contradiction, but as the vicar of Christ, as the successor of St. Peter, I solemnly declare that it is not a contradiction, but it is a development. And that is his final word. Now, in terms of how the liberals are seeking to push the controversial issues using Newman's development of doctrine, and they also claim that the Church has contradicted itself on a number of issues, you know, whether it's on the on Jews or on slaves, as you said, or on how other religions are viewed, or salvation outside the Church, or heliocentrism and geocentrism for that matter, Now, some might argue that some of these were prudential judgments, but others would say, again, you are moving the goalposts and this is just insufferable sophistry. If we want the answer, we simply have to rest assured that the vicar of Christ, the successor of St. Peter, in this case, Pope Francis, has the supreme authority to do so, and he is doing what he has the power to do.
I guess that some people might, looking back over history, say that the progressive teaching has been more like a river rather than random contradiction. And although there have been twists and turns in the course of the river, ultimately the trajectory of the river has been straight. It's gone from the spring to the sea. One of the things we might do, I suppose, is to ask exactly what the Pope has said, because as so often, it is set in the context of ambiguity. He has said that marriage has to be preserved and a distinction between homosexual coupledom and heterosexual marriage must be kept. Because this cuts both ways. The liberals are delighted because they're saying you can't accuse him of tangenting the teaching of the church because he's defended marriage. And because you and I both know that in terms of the political debate, because this is exactly what happened in Anglicanism, they start off with a pastoral measure, with a bit of blessing, a bit of kindness, a bit of niceness. And before long, couples are turning up dressed in bridal gear and treating the whole thing as a wedding. And the next stage is it becomes a wedding. So we're not particularly persuaded that the distinction between blessing and marriage is safe at this stage. But if the Pope hasn't changed the doctrine of marriage or sexual relationships between people, then presumably some people can say he's called for merciful pastoral judgment. If people want a blessing, they can have a blessing. But one can presume that couples are acting chastely within their relationships because that's the teaching of the church. And he's speaking as the Pope, the custodian of the teaching of the church. He hasn't said he's changing the teaching of the church. He's just invoking a blessing. Is there room, Jules, for people to say jurisprudentially that his remarks on blessings should be taken within the context of the stable teaching of the church on sexual practice between people?
There are three ways I can respond to this, Gavin. First of all, the business about continuity and discontinuity. I was listening to the great professor John O'Malley, famous Jesuit historian, his lecture at the Pontifical Gregorian University, where he taught for many years. And I've just finished reading his book on the Council of Trent. And in that lecture, he says that thanks to Trent, Catholics have this understanding. He calls it a myth of continuity. And he says we need to get over that because there have been a number of significant ruptures and points of discontinuity in Catholic teaching and doctrine. And the sooner we get rid of this misunderstanding created by Trent, the better, he says. So that's one point. The second point has to do with what is definitive. And I really like the way Pope Francis responded to the first dubium. Very, very cogent, very clear. My speculation, of course, is that this is the work of a very clever ghostwriter in the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith. And there'd be nothing wrong with it, because most papal documents are ghostwritten. And of course, at the end, it has the editorial hand of Cardinal Victor Manuel Fernandez. And in this first response on the nature of authoritative teaching, Pope Francis responds, and he says that, let me quote, a clear and authoritative doctrine on the exact nature of definitive statement has not yet been fully developed. He's right. Because apart from infallible teachings, there is considerable debate among canon lawyers, among theological experts, as to what really constitutes a clear and there is no doctrine as such on the exact nature of a definitive statement. And that needs to be developed, which again, I said he's absolutely right about that, or the ghostwriter is right. But thirdly, when we look at this particular text, which, by the way, is magisterial, because in the same way that the 2021 dubia, you know, which was sent out from the DDF by Archbishop Giacomo Morandi with Pope Francis' signature, banning same-sex blessings, categorically, in fact, That was highly, regarded, particularly by conservatives, faithful Catholics, because they said this is a magisterial statement. Now, of course, you can't say that was magisterial, and this current Pope's response to the Dubia is not magisterial. So we are talking about the genre of the text, but at the same time, we are recognizing that the form, if you want to use a term from form criticism here, is highly diplomatic in nature. It is written in a style that is intended to be multi-layered, polysemous, that can have varied interpretations. I mean, as a biblical scholar, I taught hermeneutics, and our friend Victor Manuel Fernandez, the cardinal in charge of the DDF, his guru, his hero, is the famous German hermeneutician Hans Georg Gadamer, whose basic thesis is that different people can take different meanings from a text. And this is precisely what our friend Fernandez is doing. He's playing the Gadamerian game. So conservatives can twist themselves into pretzels and read what they want from this text. And at the same time, liberals can go away absolutely thrilled that the Pope has opened the door to same-sex unions.
Well, not everyone will know that you have your doctorate from Cambridge University. So when it comes to swapping cudgel blows and intellectually, you're up there with the best of them, and you're entitled to offer us your judgment. So thank you for doing it. I was very impressed, as you are too, by the author love who lay behind the Dubia. I love that very clever aside when he says, if you want to ask about synodal conversations, the Dubia itself is a form of synodality, and you've just entered into it. So if you're going to ask me about the legitimacy of a process that you've initiated and entered into, don't be surprised if I say yes. I thought that was extremely clever in terms of a response. But leaving aside to sort of the point winning for the moment, I think there are two issues, aren't there? One is, what hope have the faithful for a return to the clarity of Catholic teaching in a way that is consistent with 2,000 years? There may be twists and turns, but there isn't anarchy and there isn't contradiction. But the second is a political one, really. This is going to make life very difficult for the whole Catholic Church. If, as we see, there's a civil war within the Catholic Church as outside it, and it's a civil war between the scripture and tradition on one side and a form of secular spirit of the age on the other. This is a very heavy blow in favor of the spirit of the age. What effect is this going to have, do you think, on the confidence of Catholics as they struggle with maintaining the integrity of their faith against the onslaught, the tsunami that's hit the church over the last 50 to 100 years and has intensified in the last decade?
Before I answer that question, Gavin, may I just add the wider context of same-sex blessings already taking place in Germany, Italy, Belgium, etc., and Pope Francis not uttering a single word of censure against what is happening. In fact, Bishop Johann Bonny of Belgium said that he had met the Pope, he had asked the Pope if he approves, and the Pope said, yes, he does. Now, of course, we only have Bishop Bonny's word for that, not the Pope's word. But this is the wider context in which we must read this document. Well, to answer your question about the future of the church, I was talking to somebody in England yesterday, and he said, well, imagine a faithful Catholic priest refusing to bless a same-sex union. And the couple immediately rushing off to the media and saying, look what Father, D'Souza has done. Look at how bigoted, narrow-minded Father D'Souza is. When Pope Francis has opened the doors, he's so merciful. He's encouraging his priests to discern and offer same-sex blessings. So it is going to have a catastrophic effect on the morale of faithful priests, first of all. Secondly, it is going to have a very major, it's going to be a huge blow to Catholic evangelists and faithful Catholics who want to go preach the gospel and bring people into the fullness of the Catholic Church. Because people are now going to say, as they're already doing on the internet, how can you call us to a church where you can't even make up your minds on whether homosexuality is moral or immoral, and your own Pope has done so? These are two major areas. It's also going to create a huge impediment to vocations because new priests who want to, young men who want to join the priesthood are going to ask themselves, if there is so much of confusion at this stage, what can I expect in another 10 years?
That's very much the case because we know, of course, from the Anglican experience that that's exactly what's happened to Anglican clergy and those clergy who said that, in terms of their conscience and their understanding of the teaching of Jesus and the discipline of the church, that they weren't prepared to do it, were hounded by the media and by all progressives. There's an interesting quote that's emerged in the last couple of days on the internet from Joseph Ratzinger when he was younger, which is. So he said, "We wish to make it clear that departure from the church's teaching or silence about it in an effort to provide pastoral care is neither caring nor pastoral. Only what is true can be ultimately be pastoral." Presumably, Jules, Catholics are going to hope that if the Pope, speaking magisterially, can change a doctrine like this, Francis' successor can change it back. Is there any likelihood, politically, do you think, that cardinals, even ones appointed by the present pope, will look at the effect of this and reconsider the kind of theology they want the office holder to have? After all, one of the implications of this is not that those who are traditional are in any way homophobic or prejudiced. Those of us who've grown up over the last 30 years have been fully immersed in a heterodox culture. It's more the fact that the Catholic teaching on sexuality, that sex is not about pleasure, it's about procreation, is an essential antidote to the addiction to sex and sexuality that secularism has fallen into, with such disastrous consequences for the stability of couples, of families, of communities. In other words, the Catholic teaching, astonishingly, over the last decades, has turned out not to repress, but actually to make perfectly good sense and to act as a form of glue beyond the lure of our own appetites. What's the likelihood that cardinals are going to see this and vote in a pope who will reverse the teaching of the present holder of the office?
Gavin, you've put it so beautifully and so succinctly in terms of the distinction between pastoral practice and theological doctrine. I used to tell my students when you look at the Pauline epistles, the first part consists of Paul's doctrinal indicatives, what God has done for us in Christ. And the second part always consists of doctrinal imperatives, what we do ethically. And the doctrinal imperatives are inextricably linked with the moral imperatives, ethical imperatives are inextricably linked with the doctrinal indicatives. And so, however much we might try, we cannot separate pastoral practice or prudential judgment, as people like to call it, from doctrinal indicatives. Now, what's the future like? The Synod on Synodality is going to be crucial in determining how the next pope is elected, because what Pope Francis has actually put in motion is a different model of doing church. And this is one of the things that the five Dubia cardinals are protesting. If this model takes off, and if this begins to thrive, the cardinals are going to see the future pope in a very different manner. They're going to want to vote for somebody who no longer considers himself as the monarch, if you want to call it that, but as a first among equals, a primus inter pares, which is the model that the Orthodox, Eastern Orthodox, would like to see. We also know that Pope Francis has overwhelmingly stacked the deck, the College of Cardinals, with people of his choice. And from what I'm told, unless there is a miracle, the next pope might well be a Francis II. However, having said that, or that there could be some cardinals who have not only woken up to the confusion that has been created, but also to the terrible hemorrhaging of Catholics. Because Catholics are leaving the church in droves, and new statistics last week about Italian churches, it's going to go the way of Britain in Italy, I'm afraid. So it's that serious. And if they see that Benches are empty, pews are empty. People are not coming in to buy what is being sold, are not coming in for the zeitgeist, the spirit of the age. Then they might decide to vote for a more conservative pope. Also, they've been kind of put on a merry-go-round and they are fed up of constantly receiving missives and projects and what to do from Rome. And they might just want to settle for a quieter life and therefore vote for a pope who is both doctrinally stable and also is not going to introduce so many initiatives. I'm being told that somebody like Cardinal Matteo Zuppi, the current Archbishop of Bologna and the president of the Conference of Italian Conference of Bishops, is a very good candidate who is being seen as a peacemaker. He's already gone to Russia, the Ukraine, China, etc. Diplomat, a person who will be open to both conservatives and liberals. He is much liberal in that sense, but he's not going to do things like closing down the Latin Mass and all that sort of thing. So it's somebody like this who can keep the status quo for some time at least that the cardinals most likely will be voting for.
Given that power is as important to some people as sex, it's entirely possible that the cardinals may be jealous of their right to appoint the pope's successor and prefer somebody who won't pursue the synodal path, which dilutes the influence of the cardinals when it comes to the appointment. Jules, thank you so much for joining us. It's been enormously helpful. I'm just reminded of Pope Francis's early days when approaching the World Youth Day in Rio de Janeiro, he said to the youth, "I want to tell you something. What is it I expect as a consequence of this day? I want a mess. We knew that there would be great disorder on this occasion, but I want trouble in the dioceses." He's produced a mess. He's produced trouble in the dioceses. Of course, the liberals and progressives will be thrilled and very, very glad for him. So I suppose the response to the Pope will very much depend upon one's own spirituality. Jules, thank you very much for coming and joining us and giving us the background to this. Clearly, these next few weeks will be critical in the history and the life of the Church. We're very grateful for you coming to offer your commentary and your analysis with such skill. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Gavin, for having me on.